right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today. I'm not even going to spend a whole lot of time introducing it, except to tell you that at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with writer-poet Claudia Rankine about her most recent book, Citizen, an American Lyric. And we're also going to be talking with Shirley Jo Finney, who's a director, and Bernard K. Addison, who's one of the actors in a play that was adapted from the book. Okay, and it's a remarkable, remarkable play and a remarkable book, so it's really going to be interesting to check this one out, and in particular, given the conditions that we're living in today, and in conjunction with the first part of our show, which is an interview with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about Ferguson, Missouri, the one-year anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, of the murder of Michael Brown by the police in Ferguson, and the upsurge that was going on in Ferguson all this last week, and the call for a massive, massive, massive demonstration in New York City on October 24th, and how all that ties together, and how you got to be there no matter what. All right, I'm very pleased to open up the show with my guest, Carl Dix. Now, many of you know Carl's voice. You know of Carl and about Carl because we featured him for quite some time. We featured him on a regular basis talking about the fight against the slow genocide of black and brown people in this country, the fight to stop police brutality, to end mass incarceration. And right now, Carl is in the midst of a tour that's going around the country building for Rise Up October, Which Side Are You On?, which is a plan to have on October 24th in New York City to have 100,000 and more people in the streets to shut it down. And Carl's on tour right now going around with a crew of people that are going around with Carl talking about this.
Yes, it is.
Okay, Carl, so let me welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
So it's a crew of people going around on tour. Tell us about that in the beginning, all right?
Yes. We have had people go to Cleveland. We've hit Chicago. And right now we're wrapping up the stop of the tour in Ferguson, where we were for 1 year after the murder of Michael Brown, August 7th through the 10th. Some of us are still here. And we're taking the message of stop police terror, which side are you on, through those cities. Along with me are some family members of police murder victims, Mertilla Jones, the grandmother of Ayanna Stanley Jones, the 7-year-old girl who was murdered by police who raided her grandmother's house where she was sleeping on the couch in the living room, came in with a flashbang grenade and shooting and shot Ayanna in the head. This was a SWAT team raid that broke into the wrong apartment, and no police have been punished. No authority figures have been punished for that murder. Also, Andre Smith, the mother of Justin Smith, who was murdered by police in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1998, and Josh Logan, a young man from New York City whose uncle, John Collado, was murdered by the NYPD in 2012. There are also some young people, some from the Revolution Club, touring with us, and Reverend Jerome McCory, the faith coordinator for the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, has also been on the tour.
All right. Well, tell me this, Carl. You know, as you guys are going around on the tour and as you said, you ended up in Ferguson, or you've most recently been in Ferguson. This is a very, very intense time. And particularly, we're looking at a year that's passed since the brutal murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson and all that was unleashed in the response to that, both on the side of the system as well as on the side, and most importantly, on the side of the people in terms of standing up and fighting against this. Let's look at the situation now. What's changed? What's happened in that year between now and the murder of Mike Brown?
Well, this has been a year, most importantly, of a level of resistance to the horror of police murder, murder by police, that we have not seen in this country in decades, ushered in by the defiant young people in Ferguson who went into the streets after the police gunned down Michael Brown, who had his hands up when Darren Wilson shot him. But they left his body laying for 4.5 hours in the street, and the young people were like, this is it. We're not taking this anymore. They had seen police brutalize and murder people before, but this was the straw that broke the camel's back. They went into the streets, and in the face of everything the authorities could throw at them, tear gas, rubber bullets, sound cannons, armored personnel carriers, police in riot gear with military assault weapons, curfews, National Guard mobilizations. These youth stayed in the street night after night, and it called forth a response from around the country where other people, people who were tired of dealing with the police getting away with murder, began to step out in solidarity with the Ferguson protests and in protest of the police murders happening in other parts of the country. And then when the system slapped us all in the face by exonerating Darren Wilson, the cop who murdered Michael Brown, and following that up very quickly by exonerating the cop who choked Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York City, to death, a murder that we all saw because it was videoed and seen not only across the country but around the world, protests exploded on an even higher level. So that's one big part of what's been happening over this year. But the other thing is that the killings have continued. Police have continued to kill people at a rate of more than 1,000 per year. They've killed around 700 people this year. They've killed 1,080 people since August 9th of last year, since the murder of Michael Brown. 1,080 people have been killed by police, and the system continues to exonerate killer cops, to give them a pass, to flash a green light to their brutal and murderous activity. So those are the two things that have happened, and the coming together of that is what convinced Cornel West and I that we had to issue the call for Rise Up October, because the system has doubled down on unleashing their cops to brutalize and murder people and on exonerating those killer cops. So we felt that we had to take the resistance to a much higher level, not just responding to each horror that they commit, each murder that they commit, but to take the resistance beyond that. And that's why we called for a national march that is going to be a huge outpouring of people into New York City under the theme of Stop Police Terror, Which Side Are You On?
You're listening to
October 24th, by the way. That's the date.
Okay, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's currently down in Ferguson, Missouri, and he's there as part of the protest marking the one-year anniversary of the brutal murder of Michael Brown by the police. Now, Carl, you know, one of the things that seems to be coming, and it's been a debate all year, but it seems to be, you know, I want to talk to you about this. You're out here on a tour, you're talking to people about the need to rise up, to stand up against this, and now, I know in your statement, you made a very, very powerful statement about it was right for the youth to rise up a year ago after the murder of Michael Brown, and it's right for them to continue rising up today. Is that controversial? How are people responding to that?
Well, there is controversy on it, but one side of that controversy is that it is welcomed by a lot of people who are really tired of this, who see that they have not stopped, that getting cameras that record some of these horrible murders, while it's led to a few indictments, there have been many more cases where there were videos of what the police did, where you could see that people were unarmed, where you could see that there was no criminal activity being carried out, and police have got away with literally murdering people. And in the face of that, it's hitting people that they are killing us. I mean, I've been calling this a genocide targeting Black and Latino people for a while now. And that's something that is hitting home to people, and they want to see it stopped. And when somebody comes to them and stands with them in standing up against it, they welcome that. And then when you say, we got to take that higher, they want to know, well, what's the plan? How is this going to work? What are we going to do? How do we make this happen? But at the same time, you got voices coming at it the other way, saying, well, let's get practical. Let's come up with some concrete policies and programs and laws that the authorities can enact that will deal with this problem. And this began even before the grand jury results that exonerated the killer cops in the Ferguson and Staten Island case. You had Obama call people to the White House and say, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to get body cameras and put them on the police. And then that way we'll know what happened, and that will allow us to deal with this problem. And then a couple days later, the grand jury looking into the murder of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, where there was a video, so you could see what happened, decided to exonerate all the cops who killed Eric Garner. They've told us, well, we'll get special prosecutors. That will take care of it. Leaving out the fact that John Crawford, the young black man who was gunned down by police in Beaver Creek, Ohio, while inside a Walmart where he was purchasing a toy gun that he had on his shoulder as he talked on the phone. It was a special prosecutor who looked into that case, who watched the video of the cops storming into Walmart and gunning him down and then saying to him, drop it. There was a special prosecutor in Wisconsin, which is a state that has a law mandating special prosecutors, in the murder of Dontre Hamilton, a young man who was asleep in the park in the afternoon, accosted by a cop who began to beat him and then shot him to death. The special prosecutor exonerated that cop. Then in the case of Tony Robinson, a young man who needed help, somebody called the cops. The cops came, kicked in the door to Tony's apartment, and then shot him through the door, even though he was unarmed. The special prosecutor exonerated that cop, too. So every policy change that they say is going to deal with this, every law that they say is going to make this stop, continues to allow this to go on. And what it points to is that there needs to be a sea change in how people in this society look at the question of policing, police being unleashed to wreak violence, especially on the ghettos and barrios and the people that live there in this country, and the way that the system does not punish any of these killer cops. There needs to be massive outpouring, like we're calling for October 24th in New York City. And we have to challenge people over which side are you on.
Yeah, Carl, I want to talk with you about October 24th in just a few minutes. But before we get into that, I wanted to talk to you about, you've been, you know, what's going on in Ferguson right now. And you've been talking about this, especially after we've just been talking about the point about it was right for the youth to rise up a year ago after the murder of Michael Brown, and it's right for them to continue rising up today. And sort of the situation in the country overall, where it's not a backing off, it's not a lessening of the oppression and repression that's coming down, but actually there's a steady, you know, intensification of this. And I wanted to talk to you about sort of what's happened in Ferguson over the last few days. It's been fairly, I think, jarring for a lot of people to see on the very anniversary of the murder of Michael Brown that there were all kinds of things going on, not just going on in the streets, but the response of the police and the authorities to it was pretty brutal, right?
Exactly. I mean, when we hit Ferguson at the beginning of the weekend, the police put on officer-friendly masks and were handing out water and popsicles to people out on the street. But then when people took to the streets in protest, those masks came off. And, you know, you could have been last year in Ferguson because you had cops out there with armored personnel carriers. You had people being maced for wanting to protest. A state of emergency was declared in St. Louis County, but it was a particular kind of state of emergency, one that meant that you couldn't protest in the area where Michael Brown was murdered. You would be corralled on the sidewalk by an outpouring of police. You could get maced or pepper sprayed, smoke grenades thrown at you. However, the Oath Keepers, right-wing fascist folks, could come into that area armed during the state of emergency and were welcomed by the police and, in fact, collaborated with them as a message of suppression to people, that you can't stand up, that you can't bring your righteous anger to the streets. And the youth weren't having it. They came out in numbers. They came out in the face of massive police mobilizations. They rejected this thing of, oh, it's the criminal element that's coming out and we have to suppress them. They're not legitimate protesters, which is a narrative that they try to put out, demonizing and criminalizing the youth to justify the violence that they direct at them in order to suppress them. But it was very powerful and very positive that the young people, especially the defiant young people, came out, and that people, all other kinds of people also were active this weekend, because Monday there was a civil disobedience activity in different parts of St. Louis, starting with a march of hundreds of people on the federal building in downtown St. Louis, where about 60 people were arrested for engaging in civil disobedience. And I was among those 60 people, along with Dr. Cornel West and others, and along with some bloggers and live streamers who were recording what was happening, who got arrested for doing so, including D-Ray and Netta, two of the people who rose to the forefront a year ago in the response to the murder of Michael Brown. But the cops were very brutal, but people came out against that. There were also concerts by a number of artists. I'm going to name a few of them and probably forget some, but Talib Kweli performed at a hip-hop concert. Tom Morello was part of a rock concert. The band Outer National, Boots Riley performed Immortal Technique, Common, and I'm probably forgetting some people, but a lot of people felt they had to be here, and they had to be here to remember Mike Brown, but also to say this murder by police and the exoneration of these killer cops has got to stop. And that's an important step because the dogs are still in the street. The police are still killing people. It was right and important for people to stand up and rebel against that a year ago. And it is just as right and just as important that they continue to stand up.
Hey, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's currently down in Ferguson, Missouri, and he's there as part of the protest marking the one-year anniversary of the brutal murder of Michael Brown by the police. Let's talk about October 24th now, get into it a little bit more, you know, because you mentioned that earlier in the interview, and I really wanted to pursue this because a lot of the stuff that we're talking about raises the question for things to be, you know, to really take hold, to really take things to a whole other level, to really create a situation in society where this whole assault on black and brown people is pushed back. You know, this kind of development around October 24th seems to be something that could be pivotal in doing that. And I wanted to ask you this. Why don't we talk about how important October 24th is? And I'd also like you to speak to just who the hell you're looking at being involved in this.
Okay, well, let me start with the second part first. Everybody who sees the problem of police getting away with murdering people, and disproportionately black and Latino people, is who we're looking to get involved. We're looking to get involved the young people who are being criminalized and demonized by the system to justify the brutality and murder that gets unleashed on them. We're looking to involve students, young people who are growing up in a world where this goes on and targets people because of the color of their skin and find that kind of world intolerable. We're looking to involve professional people who don't want to stand aside and see this happen to others and, you know, stay on the sidelines. We're looking to involve the clergy. We're looking to go into the communities very broadly and bring people out to stand with the young people who are being targeted. We want to bring forward family members and other loved ones of those who've lost their lives at the hands of the police and bring them forward in large numbers to speak from the heart about the devastation that the horror of police murder has wrought on their lives and give them a platform to call that out, to condemn it, and to call forward people to stand with it. And we're launching a project to bring hundreds of family members of police murder victims to New York City, and that's going to be out there in the days to come. That's who we're looking to get involved. And the point is, we just got to change the way people look at this problem. It's got to be a thing of people seeing this and getting these are not isolated incidents that seldom happen, and nor are they the result of bad choices, criminal activity, or suspicious movements that the victims make, but it's the result of police being unleashed to inflict brutality, violence, and murder on people, sections of people that this society has no future for. especially the young people growing up in the inner cities, that they don't have legitimate ways for them to survive and raise families. And this is the backdrop for this program of punishment that's concentrated in these police murders. And we have to put that out there for people and bring out to them that it is intolerable that this is going down, and that everybody with an ounce of justice in their hearts has to stand up, has to join the side that's saying this must stop. There is no neutrality or middle ground here. You can't say, well, I can see points on both sides. That's kind of like going into Nazi Germany and saying, well, I can see why the Jews are upset about being put in the concentration camps. But on the other hand, I can see why the Nazis are putting them there. No, there was no middle ground there. And the Germans who stood aside were, from these horrors being committed, closed their eyes, stopped up their ears. They were facilitating the genocide that was carried out here. And it's the same today, and we have to bring that to people. That's the point to grouping Stop Police Terror and Which Side Are You On? Challenging people with the reality of police getting away with murder and challenging them to get on the right side of that, the correct side, the side of acting to stop it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's currently down in Ferguson, Missouri, and he's there as part of the protest marking the one-year anniversary of the brutal murder of Michael Brown by the police. All right, Carl, now we have a few minutes left, and I want you to speak to this. When you were talking about October 24th, what do you see it accomplishing?
Well, what I see it accomplishing is radically transforming the way that people look at this question, getting them to go from sympathy with people who are suffering this to actively siding with them and acting together with them, and then getting other sections of people to go from this doesn't have any effect on me, it's not my problem, to seeing that it is all of our problems. You know, because when you hear about a 12-year-old boy like Tamir Rice gunned down in less than 2 seconds by cops because he was playing with a toy gun and they rolled up on him like he was a criminal that they had to blow away, you have to feel like that was my child out there. That was that's our children that are being hit like this. It is our sisters who are being killed in police custody when you hear about Sandra Bland or Ralkina Jones in Cleveland. That's what people have to feel. And then here's the other thing people have to feel. People have to feel how many more victims of loss of life at the hands of the cops are we going to have to make hashtags out of? How many more anniversaries, like the anniversary of the murder of Michael Brown, or before that, the anniversary of the murder of Eric Garner, are we going to have to mark? We got to get rid of this, and it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to do that. And there is leadership for that. There's Bob Bavakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who has worked on and brought forward the way out of this, how we could actually make revolution for real, and what needs to be done now to build up to that. And people need to check that out. And while they're engaging that and digging into it, and they can do that at the website revcom.us, and while they're doing that, they need to throw in to make October 24th happen. While they're still working out whether revolution is what they want or not, whether it's possible, while they're still digging in all of that, they need to throw in to make October 24th, Rise Up October, Stop Police Terror, Which Side Are You On, as powerful as possible. They need to be mobilizing people to come, organizing transportation to get people there, raising funds to make all of this possible. Right, and they can find out about that and get hooked in with that process at the websites riseupoctober.org and stopmassincarceration.net.
All right, Carl, let me ask you one more question before we go. You're on this tour. Any news on where it's headed now?
It's going to be headed to the Baltimore, D.C. area. We're going to touch in with people who rose up in response to the murder of Freddie Gray. We're going to go down into the southeast, hitting Atlanta. And there's going to be a tour going along the West Coast. at the same time, which probably means we're going to have two different tours going, because the same crew can't get everywhere that it needs to with the message that police terror must stop and which side are you on. Be on the lookout for the schedule that the tour is going to put out, and also be on the lookout for the fact that on August 27th, Cornel West and I and others are going to speak to the question of how do we stop police murder in New York City, August 27th at a church in Harlem, and that's going to be live streamed, so it's going to be available to people all across the country.
All right, and we'll keep people posted on that. Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care, man. All right, we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about Ferguson, the one-year anniversary of the murder of Mike Brown by the police down in Ferguson, the rebellions that came in the wake of that murder, and the struggle that continues up to this day. And we've been talking with Carl also about the upcoming October 24th demonstration, a day of massive, massive protest against police murder and genocide against black and brown people to be held in New York City. And again, if you want to find more information out about that, you can go to revcom.us or Stop Mass Incarceration Network or riseupoctober.org. All right, so check all that out. We're going to take a quick break with a very appropriate song that I think you'll really appreciate, and we'll be right back, so pay attention to this one.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down, and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? The dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond a question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The mother of dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In LA, maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
Welcome back. That was Gil Scott-Heron with his song, A Poem for Jose Campos Torres. And that's a song that unfortunately never loses its relevance, all right? And it still packs as powerful a punch as the day it was first sung back in the 1970s, the late 1970s. All right. A little while ago, I came on a book called Citizen, an American Lyric, and it's by Claudia Rankin, poet and author, who's an award-winning poet and author. And I was really pleased to be able to look at that book and read it. I really got a lot out of it. It really told a lot about some of the questions that people don't ever really consider all that deeply in relation to the national oppression of black people, in relation to the terrible oppression of black people in this country, what it's rooted in, and all the different facets of it. And Claudia's book does just that. And then I was really, really happy to come up on a play that was based on Claudia's book. It was an adaptation of Claudia's book. And it was at this theater that's one of my favorite theaters in the entire country. It's the Fountain Theater. It's a very progressive, very daring theater. And they produced this work that was just incredible. It's a remarkably powerful play. And I went to see it. I was really knocked back in my seat. And I have to say, everybody that was in the theater at the time was also just stunned by the time it was over. I mean, people, standing ovation, yes, but it was just stunned. There was sort of a, just so much. People were touched so deeply. And the play is called Citizen, an American Lyric. And it's an adaptation of a book by Claudia Rankine, who's the author of four collections of poetry. She's edited numerous anthologies, including American Women Poets in the 21st Century, Where Lyric Meets Language. And she's a recipient of fellowships from the Academy of American Poetry, National Endowments for the Arts, and many other things. She's currently the Henry G. Lee Professor of English at Pomona College. And Claudia is also going to be joined a little later in the show by Shirley Jo Finney, who's an award-winning international director and actress. And she's the director of the play that's Citizen, the adaptation of the book Citizen, that's at the Fountain Theater. And along with Shirley Jo, we have Bernard K. Addison, who's an actor who's been performing at large and small theaters in Los Angeles and all over the country and everywhere else, too.
That's
welcome,
right.
Bernard.
Thank you.
Okay. And Claudia, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. Shirley Jo, welcome.
Oh, hi.
Okay, now, let's get a grip.
All of these introductions were so wonderful. I was like, okay, I'm listening and absorbing. Hello, good morning, everyone.
But you know all those people. Anyway. All right, Claudia, we're going to start with you, okay?
That's okay, Michael.
Okay. Here. The title of your book, Citizen and American Lyric. Let's talk about that title for a minute, because you've spoken about this as being an attempt to pull lyric back into reality. And I was really curious about what you're talking about there.
Well, there's a sense in poetry that it belongs in the world of the imagination and feelings. And it's a private investigation of things that have to do with personal stuff that goes on for a person. But I felt, you know, for me, writing, there's no personal life without a public life. And the dynamics around being an American really determines the kinds of personal feelings that you have. So I wanted to be able to marry those internal feelings with our reality, with the situations that we negotiate every day.
You know, it's interesting, too, though, because for me, when you say the Citizen and American Lyric, I know what you're talking about there. And I also had this thing of, it just reminded me, just the word citizen in the context of what's going on over the whole history of this country. And then the story that's always presented to people, it's like, you know, you go around the world and people are like, yo, you know, things might be bad. They might be here. They might be this. They might be that. But you know what? It's actually, everybody's free there and everybody's equal. And I kept thinking about what your title, when you call it an American Lyric, for some reason, it just kept pounding at my head is the point about, yeah, a citizen, but no rights that a white person is obliged to respect, going back 150 years to the Dred Scott decision. And I kept thinking that dichotomy that exists here is a big part of your work.
Well, that also was part of it, the sense that for African Americans, that word citizen took a long time to embody. And in many ways, we're still trying to stand fully in it. So the reality is that African Americans began as property in this country. And then we had the three-fifths, the sense that you were three-fifths human. And now we see black bodies being treated as expendable by the police force. So it's been a struggle to hold the identity of citizen for African Americans.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, too, is that you talk a lot about, and it's interesting, Claudia, because when I sent out an email about publicizing that I was going to have you on the show and we were going to be talking with Shirley Jo and Bernard at the same time, I got a lot of people writing to me, which I don't normally get. I get, people before the show anyway, people writing saying, oh, I read that book. I'm really glad about that. Or people saying how deeply moved they were by this. And one person in particular kept talking to me about how he had been wrestling with, since he first read your book, when it first came out, he had been wrestling with this concept of the breach between self-self and historical self for black people. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk about that a little. What do you mean by that?
Well, I woke up this morning. I wasn't really thinking about myself as as an African American. I was thinking of myself as somebody who has to work out and have breakfast.
join the crowd.
And later, you know, get on the phone with you guys. So that, for me, is the self-self. It's that person who's just negotiating their life. But then the historical self is that when you walk out into public as an African American, you know, people look over and what they see is not you but a black person. And once they identify you as a black person, in comes all of the stereotypes around blackness and all of the projections of the white imagination on what that means to them. And so then I feel like I fall out. I'm no longer sort of present. Instead, I have this white imagination negotiating my skin color in whatever way they feel they need to do that. And that's when I think we start behaving through history and through against, for, you know, in whatever preposition you want to put there. But then history begins to negotiate what happens next.
One thing I think in relation to this too, because it's, you know, and I'm not a big sports person, all right, but when I saw the Serena Williams part that you did when I saw it in the play, when I read it in your book, I was extremely just really impacted by that. And you make a point about this is one area that combines kind of both of those things, the self-self and the historical self, and how they blend together in a certain sense, like you're talking about, but they also are working at, you know, different frequencies in a certain level. But it was a place where everybody could see it.
Yeah, well, that, you know, racism comes down to seeing it, right? it's about the white imagination's projections and what they think they're seeing. And so sports is a great place to look, because you can go back and check it, look it up, replay it. Even as it's happening, it's often, if you're watching it on television, it's often replayed and replayed. So the moment gets examined and reexamined. So it's one of those, you know, the things with microaggressions in terms of racism is that you're never quite sure. You're like, wait, did they really intend to hurt me? Did they really mean what they said? And so with sports, they play it again, and you're like, whoa, oh, wait, that really did happen.
Mm-hmm.
She really did do that against Serena. You know, right now I'm writing a piece on Serena Williams, and the question of whether or not, if she wins the calendar Grand Slam, you know, what will that mean? She's already the greatest women's tennis player we've seen, and that sense that she has to keep adding and proving herself is all about race.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Rankin, poet, writer, and author of the book Citizen, An American Lyric. And this is a book that's a provocative meditation on race, fusing prose and poetry, movement, music, and the visual image. And we're also talking with Shirley Jo Finney, who's the director of the play adapted from the book, and Bernard K. Addison, who's one of the actors in the play. Shirley Jo, you just sounded like you wanted to comment on that. Did you want to say something about that?
Well, no, I'm just wanting Claudia to talk. But
okay.
What you heard was a vocalization I call witnessing. So when she said that you have to continue to prove and win and prove and win and prove and win, which is exhausting. I was relating to that. That's all.
Well, what brought you to this project? What brought you to this project? That's one of the things. I'm familiar with your work, and you know, as we've talked, you've been on the show before, and the plays that I've seen that you've directed have always just knocked me back in my seat. What brought you to this one in particular?
Well, Stephen Sacks called and had read a review of Claudia's work in the New York Times, and he told me about it because I hadn't seen it at that point, and said that he felt that this project lent itself and the time was right and it was the perfect storm and it had an immediacy to it. And this was after and pursuing the rights to it. And he wanted me to read it to see if I was interested in doing it. And so he sent me a copy of the book, and whereupon I read the book. And it was like, oh, here's a story of my life traveled. And when I accepted and met with Claudia, I first accepted doing the project. And doing the project was like opening a door on a life's journey that I have participated and experienced. And it was just really interesting how destiny brought this project to me. And then we both met Claudia in Pasadena, and we walked this journey together. And that's how it happened.
Mm-hmm. Bernard,
yes.
I have to ask you, what brought you to the show? I mean, you had to make a decision to come in and say, I want to do this. What brought you there?
Well, the journey was that I got a call from Stephen.
Stephen's calling everybody up, right?
Stephen's calling everybody. He's doing his due diligence to make this happen. I've done several shows at the Fountain before and also worked with Shirley Jill before. And he called me up and he said he's working on this project. And he described the project to me. And based on my experience with Shirley Jill, I just said, okay, let me jump in. And the timeliness of it, you know, is one thing, but I always think it's always timely. Someone mentioned that in one of our talkbacks that we keep saying how timely this work is, but this would have been a timely work 10 years ago.
Or 400 years
or
ago.
Or 400 years. Years ago, or 50 years in the future, because this is an ever-evolving issue for this country. And so by, you know, accepting, I joined the, you know, I joined the company, and we did a reading of it, and then immediately from the reaction, we were going to put it up. And so that's my journey to it.
Claudia, back to you for a minute. You mentioned when we were talking, you mentioned microaggressions. And I have to say, it's, you know, when you first read the book, you're going through this, and it's kind of hits you. And in my case, it hit me maybe sooner, I don't know, but it's sort of like I'm reading this, and all of a sudden, I realized right before I got to where you talk about the relationship between the microaggressions and the terrible things that are going on, you know, and have been going on generally throughout history, but there's this relationship between what some people would derisively refer to as, well, it's just that he or she is too sensitive, you know, I made a mistake, I did this, I did that, you know, oh, come on, can't we get past that, you know, all this kind of stuff that goes on. And you've talked about these microaggressions actually having a very deep relationship with the bigger question and what today even comes down to, the slow genocide that's being unleashed. That's what I say, but you didn't say that. Although you're welcome to.
One of the important things about having Shirley Jo on the piece and Bernard is that in the making of the stage adaptation, there were bodies and people and intelligences that understood what it felt like to have the accumulative life of microaggressions in their own bodies. And I think part of the success of the production has to do with that, that, you know, Shirley Jo obviously is brilliant at what she does, but I also think it helps that it wasn't a sense of having to, let me see if I can understand what you mean. You know, that kind of thing didn't have to happen. So in that sense, that is really gratifying in seeing the adaptation. In terms of the connection between the accumulation in one's body of these small aggressions, these small comments and erasures, and the bigger aggressions in society, the structural racism in the police departments, inside of one's own places of work, inside, and even the sort of odd moments like Dylann Roof just showing up in a church and murdering 9 people. Those things, I think, they're homegrown, and they're all of a piece. And I think that one of the things that we as Americans have to begin to understand is that things don't just happen.
Yeah.
They come out of a long history, and a history that we are bolstering up constantly. So that if you have a police who shoots a black man without justification, and then that goes to the courts, and the court says that there was provocation when it didn't exist. That's another way of bolstering it up. If you have Katrina, where the relief, FEMA refuses to go in because it's black bodies, and those bodies don't matter, then that's another way of bolstering it up. And then you have a Dylann Roof who feels like, oh, it's my duty to go and kill 9 black people simply because they're black. That is not separate from those other moments, from what we're seeing inside of police departments or in Katrina or in these small comments that are said to people of color daily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Rankin, poet, writer, and author of the book Citizen, An American Lyric. And this is a book that's a provocative meditation on race, fusing prose and poetry, movement, music, and the visual image. And we're also talking with Sherry Jo Finney, who's the director of the play adapted from the book, and Bernard K. Addison, who's one of the actors in the play. Now, Sherry Jo, you talked about when you first got this play that you sort of looked at it, you wrestled with it, and you understood that to get to the heart of what the issues that the play is presenting, that it has to be made very personal. Let's talk about that.
Oh, I said that just now, today, this morning?
No. You said it in something else that I read.
Oh. Boy, I need some more healing. Anyway. What I wanted to respond to, and I think I'll answer your question, was going into this play for the company, and a lot of my work is always dealt with the historical and also the wound of America. And then, and so I know when I have a piece or a project that deals with the historical wound, that the actors, the company, has to come to terms with their own, whether it's xenophobia, the prejudices, or the bigotry. So, or the dark side, as I call it. And so when we're at table, before we even mount the play, we go into a personal narrative. And in this particular process, we had 2 white actors and we had 4 black actors. And I know Bernard is from South Carolina, and one of our other actresses, Lisa Pesci, who is from South Carolina also. Lisa was struggling with her historical self being a Southerner. And in the at the table, and Bernard, you can speak to this, mm-hmm. at the table, one has to go past their own fear of the conversation. And that's what we did for 2 days. We were in the conversation, our own personal conversation. And that sharing was informative. And it provided a clearing for everyone. And people were saying they didn't know why they said yes to this project after reading it. But with something about it, there was, I think it was, I'm going to say, spirit that said, you have an appointed time. This is your time to be here. And not knowing why, because to have the conversation of racism, to have the conversation about the responsibility of that and the awareness is a very frightening thing. But that conversation has to happen in order to face your own truth and order to be free in your expression, in your voice. So as we were going in our process, what we found as a company, I do a thing with actors where I call check-in. I never start a rehearsal, especially when we're dealing with the subject matter, without just sitting and saying, and the one I always say is your feelings, your comments, your confusions, whatever, so that they have a clearing of expression before you tackle the material. And that has to happen. And this one was important because not only were we dealing with the subject matter inside the rehearsal hall, but when we walked out that door, there was not a line of taking off the clothes of rehearsal and putting on the clothes of the world, and then you let it go.
That's very true.
There was no letting go. There was no letting go. There was no letting go. And so it was important for us as a company to sit and be able to express all of those things that we were feeling. And what the company voiced was their awareness was heightened in their everyday reaction and encounters in the world, which was wonderful because mm-hmm. that also fed into the process of us telling the emotional truth in that piece. Now, for me, and Claudia had said that about understanding on a cellular level the material, it was, and I had voiced this before, walking in that door that I have walked in, lived in, expressed in, my living, my dying, my crying, all was popping and surfacing, and all of the emotional colors are on that stage that by the time releasing, you know, when you're giving birth, you break water. And I was in labor pains. I broke water. And when someone said, oh, Shirley Jo, are you excited? I said, I am done.
Wow.
Because I was living it. And when you live it, like I said, you're in, you're laughing, you're dying, you're crying of all of it. And yes, I'm very happy because our intention, the company's intention, my intention was to work within the space in between the lines. That's where the juice is. That's where the soul lives. On a visceral level, that's where we wanted to, because when the audience and the performer, that is the symbiotic relationship, and that heightened awareness that we experience is the heightened awareness of in the visceral that's impacted the beingness of being human.
I'm going to let Bernard respond to that because we've got about 2 minutes left, Bernard.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no, don't worry about it. No, I'm just saying I have to – normally this would have been a great show for the entire hour, and maybe we can figure out a way to do this again, but Bernard.
Well, you know, about the personal, to me it's – you know, you get a play and you look at it and you see a character. The character has a name and, you know, you do your due diligence of research and creating a personal history that is basically of the imagination. The characters on the page are called Citizen 1, Citizen 2, Citizen 3, Citizen 4, Citizen 5, Citizen 6. So there is no name. So the name is the actor. And so in order for to do the work for this particular piece, it had to be facets of my life, facets of going deeper, facets of exploring my DNA of racism, both large and small, and being able to expose myself to that. It's very interesting that I find that if you look at the people of the play, if you were to put them in a class, they would probably be upper middle class or middle class. And so from there, you can actually begin to recognize people who have found a way to maneuver through the world. And still, as they walk out, they encounter things about, oh, well, you're late, you nappy-headed hoe, that someone that thinks they can have the right to say that to you or not really thinking in that way. And so even as you move up into whatever strata you are, and for me, my strata is someone as being a teacher, educator, and also an actor. And so I've made it to some point. But even at this point, that's been because of being able, finding the way to maneuver, find a way to get through. And then when you run across something that brings you back, how do you work through that?
Yeah.
So it's been very, very illuminating for me to look at my life and look at where I have dealt, how I have dealt with microaggressions and my feelings toward the macroaggressions that we go out and look at social media and, you know, seeing what's happening on a larger scale and how that impacts me. So.
All right. And I wish we could go on much longer because you've just raised so many things to me. And you do bring that all to your work in this play. You bring it all in there, and it's
Thank you. It's
one of the reasons why I immediately want to say, you've got to be on my show. All right, I really, as hard as it is, it's breaking my heart to do this, but Bernard K. Addison, Claudia Rankin, and Shirley Jo Finney, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Claudia.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Claudia Rankin, the author of the book Citizen, an American Lyric. And it's a book that's it's a provocative meditation on race, fusing prose, poetry, movement, music, and the visual image. It's a lyric poem, all right? And we've also been talking with Shirley Jo Finney, the director of a play adapted from the book that's being staged at the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles, one of my favorite theaters, as I said earlier, and also Bernard K. Addison, who's one of the actors in that play. And that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of my guests for appearing and talking with me. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Now, I want to go out with something from Bob Avakian. I read it once before on the show, but I think it's extremely powerful, very moving, and very, very, very important in relation to everything we've been talking about today. All right, so this is from Bob Avakian. There is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness. Black people playing a crucial role in putting an end, at long last, to this system which has, for so long, not just exploited and dehumanized, terrorized and tormented them in a thousand ways, putting an end to this in the only way it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to go out now with a song that's very powerful and very, very much appropriate for the subject of today's show, and it's called Is It Because I'm Black from Syl Johnson. Talk to you again next week.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. Oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dream never came true. Oh, is it because I'm black, huh? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Holding me back, I wonder, is it because I'm black?